Welcome, everybody, to the new and improved Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdern, and my co-host, Mr. Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm doing well. And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We will break kayfabe on sports, television, movies, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. On today's show, we're going to discuss more of my top 100. We're going all over North America today. And then we're going to discuss our top five Christmas and or holiday movies that you should be watching before the holiday season. So, Barry, you about ready to go, my friend?
I am, too. You know, I just lied to you, too, so I want to apologize for that.
What? You did what?
I am not doing well. So, you know, and I think a lot of our listeners and anybody that actually knows me knows that I grew up in Florida. I grew up literally on a beach, and I live right outside of Philadelphia right now. And we have had two snowstorms in the last week. I cannot tell you how much I hate this white shit. For the life of me, having to wake up early in the morning to be able to shovel my driveway, then shovel the sidewalks and get all this out. I can't stand it. I absolutely can't. So I am making my return to Florida. Of course, it'll be for only 6 days. It'll be this December, in about 2 weeks between Christmas and New Year's. And I am looking forward to it. I cannot stand these Northeast winters.
I will only say two things. First of all, I believe you have a teenage son. That's what sons are for, shoveling the driveway. Number two.
Good point.
down here at Fort Lauderdale, I will say that a couple days ago, it got down into the high 40s. So, oh boy, I feel your pain. It was just miserable down here.
It's miserable. And I can almost take the cold, but, you know, even worse, and you and I both are dog people. So, you know, my boy likes to go outside four times a day, and I've got to walk him around the loop, which is about a mile. And last night, with the wind chill, it was 8 degrees. And this was after the snow had stopped. It was 8 degrees. It's just brutal, just absolutely brutal.
Well, my boy Gunny liked to go out and do a little walk when the wind's a little bit chilly, gets to sniff the air. But before we go too far into this dog lovers podcast, we're going to get back to wrestling here, Barry. What do you say we start in Calgary? We're going September 6, 1986. We're talking Owen Hart and Ben Bassarab versus the Viet Cong Express, which was Hiro Hase and Fumihiro Nakura. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match. Do you think it still holds up?
It does hold up, and I'll tell you, there's not a dog in this match. Sorry. This is...
Boom.
This is such a good match, too. And you know, as I was watching this match, and I haven't watched Stampede in probably 10 years. And I'm going through this, and when you watch the Viet Cong Express, first off, you know, you're really getting two guys that would really blossom and become fantastic Japanese wrestlers. And then Hase had to be pretty young here. But just, you know, the whole Viet Cong Express with manager J.R. Foley, and we had seen J.R. Foley as John Foley in Florida in 1975 when he was teaming with Dutch Mantel. And just he was a really kind of grizzled veteran even at that point. But I thought this was a great match. There's a spot in here where Ben Bassarab gives this reverse tombstone pile driver to one of the Viet Cong Express. Do you know that spot I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It looks just kills him.
Yeah, he does like a side salto into a spike pile driver. It was crazy.
Exactly, which I had never seen before. And if you've never seen Bassarab, I think that there's a guy who's really interesting that we should probably spend a little time talking about. He was a fantastic worker. He's kind of a cross to me. Physically looks like a cross between the Dynamite Kid and Davey Boy Smith. Kind of works like a cross between the two of them. Maybe not as smooth or as polished, but here's a guy that in watching him should have been a bigger star. And are you aware of why he never became a bigger star? I think
yes.
I know, but I'm not really sure.
I will just say sources have revealed to me why Ben Bassarab did not become a bigger star.
So I get it. Reading between the lines.
Yes.
So I'm going to assume for two reasons. One is he basically was married to Stu Hart's daughter and then I guess left her when she was pregnant. So I want to say, was he divorced out of the promotion?
I believe, I guess a good way to put it is he got Spike Hubert because from what I was told, he went to Stu Hart and told Stu Hart, yeah, listen, I'm not in love with your daughter. and I don't want to be with her anymore. Stu took a dim view of that, let's just say. And so much like Spike Huber, who was married to Dick the Bruiser's daughter, I believe, and then suddenly was no longer part of wrestling, pretty much Ben Bassarab stepped away from the wrestling business, mainly because no one would use him based on Stu's word, from what I understand. And which is a shame because, you know, Ben, as you were saying, he was a really good wrestler, you know, a guy that easily could have made a career that lasted another 10 or 15 years, because like you said, he was sort of a Davey Boy light, if you will, you know, maybe like somewhere between Davey Boy Pillman, a little bit less than that, but a guy that certainly could have found work. He may not have been as good as those two guys, but he certainly was a guy that could have found, you know, Johnny Smith, for God's sakes, was in Japan for like 5 years or so. Ben Bassarab easily was as good as Johnny Smith.
Oh, I think without a doubt, too. And there's a little bit of Chris Benoit, and you know, the name that we shall never say, but there was a little bit of Chris Benoit in there as well. And he's a solid, solid worker. And when you watch some of the stuff that he's doing, and you just mentioned that side salto, which goes into a reverse tombstone pile driver, which literally looked like it had killed one of the Viet Cong Express. Bassarab also had an incident in the late 80s, apparently, where he was in a bar fight, and he got stabbed. And I think it punctured his liver, and he almost died on the operating room table. So I think it's probably a combination of bar fights, getting stabbed, and obviously getting Hubert, which was that's a great analogy right there. Yeah. But this was a really, really good match. I love the fact that it goes to a draw, and then they decide to give them an extra 5 minutes to break the draw, and you've got Ed Whalen, who I've been critical of previously, going, we never see this happen on Calgary Stampede Wrestling, which I thought was great.
Yeah, and, you know, in the last 2 minutes of the match, you must have had 10 two counts. I mean, like, where they're just going for the fall, and it really, you know, one thing about Calgary, when it did matches like this, it really came off like a sporting event, you know? I mean, these guys are trying their best to win the match. Just a couple of notes about the match. For some reason, the Viet Cong Express were billed as the Golden Grappler and the Silver Fox. And what was interesting was Hirohatsu's mask was golden, had a golden tint to the top of it, and Nakura's match had a silver match, which silver tone to it, which I always thought was kind of interesting because, you know, usually the gimmick with a mask team is that they can switch and interchange. So obviously, if the masks are different colors, you sort of lose that ability, which I thought was kind of funny. Nakura, I believe, ended up retiring early. I want to say he had maybe some sort of heart problem. I know that he never became a big star in Japan, and I think it was because he retired early. Hirohashi had a tremendous run in New Japan. He's actually a member of the Japanese Congress now. He became an elected official. He's been in office for like 15 years. He was a big amateur wrestling star there before he became a pro wrestler. The thing that I don't understand, Calgary uses this yellow card system, like in soccer. You know, you commit a penalty, the ref goes up and he holds his yellow card up. And it just, I think, is so ridiculous looking. The referee in this match is a guy named Jürgen Hammer. And Jürgen Hammer, whenever the heels would break through, he'd go over and he'd wave the yellow flag at him. And Ed Whalen would be like, one more yellow card, and by God, they're going to get DQ'd. So I just thought that was kind of ridiculous. But of course, Ed Whalen, in this match, pretty much you can see that Owen Hart is the whole key to the promotion, because Owen Hart is just, he's a star in this match, and Ed Whalen is putting him over, like, you know, the way that Bill Mercer would put over Kerry Von Erich. We'll discuss that later. But Ed Whalen, it was a rare good match for Ed Whalen, because he did not interfere with the greatness of the match, if you will. And Owen, it's interesting. I was just trying to recall. I had a friend of mine who told me when Owen was first breaking out, he was become the darling of the Observers crowd, because in 1986, when he was a rookie, he was a guy like no one had seen a rookie come up and be this good this quick. And I remember I sent a tape to my good friend Jeff Steele in Mississippi. And I remember Jeff Steele saying, I don't think he's ever going to become a real big star. And I said, why? He said, well, two things. First of all, he's not that big a guy. And he goes, they're using finishing moves as transition moves. That complaint is absolutely true, because as you said, they're using a stuffed pile driver, and the guy kicks out on a one count on a stuffed pile driver or something like that. So it just comes off a little bit ridiculous. And that was, you know, sort of the evolution of the wrestling business where, you know, geez, think about it. Back in the 50s, body slams were finishing holds. And yeah. Now here, you know, now you watch a New Japan match currently on Access, and you'll see them doing stuff where it's like, oh, my God. And they must be doing 30 finishing moves, you know, that would have killed somebody. back in the 70s or have been a total finishing move, and they're just using it as transition spots. Well, here they were doing in Calgary in 1986, we're doing moves that 15 years before would have ended a match, and now it's just a transition move from one spot to the next spot. So that's kind of crazy. The match ends up going 50 minutes. Now, it's not 50 minutes on the televised version. I think you get maybe the last 15 or 20 minutes of the match, but Calgary famously during this time period would join the match in progress, and Ed Whalen would say, "Hey, we're 30 minutes into this match, folks, and so we're going to take it from here." But Owen was just tremendous at this point in his career, and I know he was Rookie of the Year and the Wrestling Observer, totally deserved, by the way.
Yeah, they were. I mean, they're all four really, really solid too. And you said something a couple of minutes ago, and it was basically about the names, the Silver Fox and the Golden Grappler. And when you look at the two guys, you look at Hase and Nick. What was his real name?
Nakira.
Nakira. When you look at them, they're physically almost identical. So it would have made sense to have them in matching outfits, which I think would have really enhanced the gimmick. But, of course, they didn't do that. But I would say this is a match, if you like to see wrestling, and this is not a brawl by any means, if you like the Dynamite Kid, the Davey Boy Smith prior to going to the WWF, if you like that style of wrestling, this is probably the match for you.
You know what else is interesting about Calgary is here you have two Japanese guys playing Vietnamese people, which is it's funny because it was 13 years after the Vietnam War was over, but apparently being Vietnamese could still get you heat in Calgary in 1986. And it was funny, Japanese guys would go over to work in Calgary, and I remember like Junji Harada, who was a strong machine in New Japan, went over to Calgary and they made him an Indian. His name, yeah. I believe, was something like Sunny Two Rivers or something like that. So they had an interesting, everybody wasn't Japanese when they came over to Calgary. They gave them different gimmicks. And, you know, so it wasn't like a constant influx of Japanese wrestlers to the fans. They were getting Indians or getting Vietnamese. It's kind of crazy. So you ready for our next match, Bear?
Let's do it, man.
The next match, we're going to go to November 12th, 1985 in New Orleans. This is about as intense and crazy a brawl as you'd ever see during the 1980s. We're talking Buzz Sawyer versus Jim Duggan. And Barry, do you think this match holds up?
It does. So this match is fantastic. And I think we said this on an episode 3 or 4 weeks ago where we said, and it was the Duggan versus DiBiase coal miner's glove match. And we said, this is probably the best match of Duggan's career. You know what? This match may be the best match of Duggan's career. It's what I like about this is you have Buzz Sawyer, and we could probably do an entire show on Buzz Sawyer, and maybe we should do an entire show on Buzz Sawyer, but right out of the gate, Duggan rolls in the ring and they start throwing punches, and these punches look stiff. This stuff looks like it's connecting. And as they're fighting, Duggan is looking at Sawyer and he's screaming at him, "Come on, you son of a bitch." And he says it twice, and they're just going at it. It's 100%. They're both guys are bloody. Sawyer's just bloody beyond belief, and he's such a maniac. You know, we always know Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer. You know, it was a shoot. You know, none of this was a gimmick for the guy. He was really, really nuts. But you know, I love it. If you watch. And what I like about watching stuff from like Mid-South and Memphis is watching the fans outside the ring. And there's a guy who's outside the ring, real skinny guy.
Yeah, I know you're talking about. Yeah.
You have to, exactly. And every time that they're fighting, this really thin guy, and he's got some sort of name tag dangling from his belt loop. He's got this like badge or something, and he's always straightening out the barricade. But while he's straightening out the barricade, he's cheering for Duggan, and he's yelling at Sawyer like he's part of the show. So I thought that was great. They have a just an amazing brawl, and then it winds up going to the back. And I think this was the genius of Watts' booking in the Mid-South area, too. They get to the back, and Duggan sees Sawyer, and he's screaming at him. And at one point, he says, and this is going to be, you know, this is not safe for work right now. He goes, "I'm going to kick your fucking ass." Did you hear that?
Yes. He's like, yeah.
He's like, "Holy cow."
He's going, wow. He's going, "You motherfucker."
Yeah, exactly. And then Sawyer is then like a lunatic on the ground going, "Duggan," and he's screaming his name. So was there real life heat between these two guys? And I ask because it certainly looks a little bit more than an angle, but at the same time, there was a lot of real life heat between Duggan and Bourne. And they had an incident, and something went back to the Mid-South days when they were together, and then they were on an indie show 3, 4, or 5 years ago, and I want to say it was kind of shortly before Bourne actually passed away, Matt Bourne passed away, and it turned into a shoot on this indie show, because they apparently really did not like each other. So I'm curious, you know, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this match, but I do wonder if there's real life heat. And then I think the question I want to ask you, when we see Sawyer, and he's got such a reputation, and I want to say all of it's bad. You know, he's got this reputation of being a complete lunatic, and I think you know this too, but I've been doing a lot of research on him as a kid when he was a high school wrestling star, and he was having issues back in high school. So this wasn't something that just started, you know, when he became professional. He had a troubled childhood, but is his legacy tarnished with all the negativity, with all these stories about all this stuff that he did to people, and the stealing of money and being high and drunk and all this stuff, does it damage his legacy? Because as a heel, if I didn't know any of this and I watched him strictly as a heel in the ring, I would say he's possibly one of the best of all time.
Well, you know, Buzz Sawyer is one of those guys, and we in a prior episode have discussed the Dynamite Kid, and we discussed how the Dynamite Kid is one of the greatest in-ring workers of all time, and I really don't think anyone can argue that. He was just a supreme, I called him a next-level talent, because he was a guy that young kids watched that were getting into the business, and they wanted to emulate the Dynamite Kid. Guys like Brian Pillman, guys like Chris Benoit, all those guys that went through Calgary, they wanted to be the Dynamite Kid. But Dynamite Kid was a horrible person. And pretty much anyone that met him will tell you stories that will just curl your hair, out the ring incidents, not just being a bully, you know, stuff in bars, just horrible, vile things that he would do, thinking they were practical jokes, but just very, very mean spirited.
Well, not to interrupt you, but the story where with John Foley, who we just mentioned from Calgary, and John Foley's daughter, have you ever heard that story? And I believe that was in one of the books that's out there. And I know that I read it in one of the books, but where John Foley paid Dynamite Kid to break John Foley's daughter's legs to get the insurance money.
I do remember that, now that you mentioned that. I was not realizing what you're talking about, but I do have some memory of that. Yeah. So anyway, getting back to Buzz Sawyer, but Buzz Sawyer in the ring, you're completely right. He was a unbelievable talent. You would watch him and just be spellbound by his character, the way that he was totally believable as this mad dog, no pun intended. He lived the gimmick, but he was, by all accounts, a kind of a horrible person. As you said, he was known to steal money from people. I sat down and did an interview with Terry Allen, Magnum TA, who flat out told me that he paid Buzz Sawyer to train him, and then Buzz Sawyer skipped town. And Terry, on the advice of Jim Garvin, had to follow Buzz up to Portland and basically confront him about the fact that he had left town. And that's just one story. There are plenty of other stories about Buzz Sawyer, not just, you know, being a bully, being a thief, you know, hurting people in the ring deliberately. He was not a nice person. But the story with Duggan was, I know the angle was that Buzz, I think, had said something. They did an angle that involved Jim Duggan's girlfriend and some sort of incident that happened with Jim Duggan, his girlfriend, and Buzz Sawyer. That was the angle that set this feud in the mix. I really don't know if they had any sort of real life heat. You're right. This was a super stiff match. It came across, there were no crazy bumps in this match. Nobody's, you know, doing the pinball routine, bouncing around the ring. This was just a straight up fight. And you had Carl Fergie was in the ring. This was a time period when Watts was using Carl Fergie and Tommy Gilbert as his officials. Cursing throughout the match, as you said, they were, you know, MF for this, you son of a bitch. They end up taking the match back to the dressing room area. The boys are trying to pull them apart. Buzz and Duggan are throwing the guys off each other. They're still cursing at one another. As they're led away to the dressing room, you can hear the echoes of Jim Duggan down the hallway going, "Kiss my ass, kiss my ass." So it yeah. really came off as a, you know, just a terrific fight. There were spots in the match. I agree with you totally, but the fans at ringside were coming up and they were yelling and screaming at Buzz, getting real close, almost trying to be part of the action. There was a great moment in this match that I really enjoyed where Buzz crawls into the corner and he's doing the cowardly beg off. And, you know, Duggan's getting close going, come on, come on, I'm going to give it to you. And Buzz does something that I really thought was interesting. Rather than doing the, you know, the crotch chop or, you know, the low blow, Buzz begs off and then leg dives Duggan going back. And I could just imagine Gordon Solie sitting there going, he's going back to the basics, back to his amateur background. And it was just a different thing that you normally wouldn't see in a brawl. And I thought that was very effectively done. Much like, you know, we talked a few weeks ago about a match from Louisville, Kentucky, and involved Bill Dundee, the Dream Machine, Kevin Sullivan, and Wayne Ferris. Part of what makes this match so great is not just the stuff in the ring, it's the aftermath. And the fact, I think what was going on here was Bill Watts was having his son Joel film a lot of house footage. And what they would do is they would show this on Power Pro Wrestling. And of course, they would not include the audio. So all the cursing that was going on in the match, which makes the match so great, by the way, was not ever shown on TV, naturally. Joel Watts would make these tapes, and I got this match from Dave Meltzer originally. So Joel Watts would send these matches to Dave Meltzer so Dave could see the house footage. And it was just tremendous because I'm sure this match was on TV, but it was this edited version. And it's hard. It sounds strange. The cursing adds so much to this match. It adds to the realism of the match to hear these guys dropping F-bombs on one another, because it wasn't like, you know, we've talked before, there's nothing that drives you crazier as a wrestling fan than to see like a Texas death match or something where the guys lock up collar and elbow at the beginning of the match. That's not what I want to see. I want to see two guys start throwing down like they're in a bar and having a fight. But no, this match, in my mind, totally holds up as one of the top 100 of the year. This might have even belonged in the top 20, quite frankly.
It's an excellent match, too. And much like the last match we talked about, I'd encourage anybody listening, especially this version with the cursing, because there's this air of believability to it. Go out of your way. You definitely want to see this.
Yeah, it's crazy good. So, okay, the next match we're going to talk about, we're going to go to July 21st in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I got to give a little caveat to this one, folks. I had gone up for the Baltimore Bash in July of 1989. It was going to be in Baltimore. We went to a show the night before in Philadelphia. And the match we're going to talk about is Ricky Steamboat versus Lex Luger. Lex Luger, I basically made my bones as a writer in the Observer readers' pages complaining about Lex Luger. And Lex Luger, beginning with Starrcade 88, began to, in my opinion, metamorphosize into all of a sudden this guy that was this big muscle head who had no oxygen. He couldn't work 5 minutes without blowing up. And he was just basically a guy that I thought that Bill Apter had created as, you know, Hulk Hogan Jr. Somewhere along the line, he turned into a very competent wrestler. He was working with guys like Steamboat. He was working with Flair. He later worked with Pillman in the year. 1989, in my opinion, was Lex Luger's best year as a wrestler by far. So what happens is we go up for the Bash, and we go to this show the night before. The night before, the match was off the charts. It probably was the best match on the card. Now, I'm sure a lot of that has to do with the fact that Ricky Steamboat was absolutely at his peak of his career and was just a tremendous performer. He absolutely made Lex Luger look like a star. Now, that being said, the following night in Baltimore at the pay-per-view event, the Baltimore Bash, they had another match. So the match that we're going to talk about, because, of course, the match in Philadelphia is not available on tape, we're going to discuss the match that is out there on tape between Ricky Steamboat and Lex Luger, July 22nd, 1989, in Baltimore at the Bash. Barry, tell me what your thoughts are on this match.
So it is kind of amazing that you just said that. So prior, and I watched this match yesterday, prior to sitting down and watching this match, I was dreading. It was the last match that I had to watch of our list of matches, and I'm like, you know, damn, do I really have to watch a Luger match? Really, do I have to watch it? And you know what? As I was watching it, I was like, have I been wrong this entire time? Was Luger not that bad? But you bring up the point. You know, he would go through these spurts, and I think 88, 89 was really a period where he was performing. But if you watch this match, his bump taking was excellent. like I was kind of shocked that he was taking these back flips and these hip tosses and taking really, really good bumps. I think to be fair with this as well, I would say that his offense was good. His selling, though, at times was terrible. And like whether it's selling a steamboat chop or a steamboat punch, he really wasn't doing a whole lot in that regard. But this is kind of, I think this goes back to the Buzz Sawyer Dynamite Kid conversation. Does Luger get this rep where because he's disliked, you know, and I have an opinion about that because I do think I met him about a year ago and I do think he is a different person. But, you know, for years he was known as having this really horrific douche personality. And does that cloud the perception of Luger? Do smarks, which is what we are, do we hate him because he was a douche, you know, outside the ring, inside the ring? Does that cloud our judgment with him? Because in watching this match, he really wasn't as bad as everybody says he was.
Well, you know, one of the things I noticed in the match was when he would take a bump, he almost took it. If you remember the way Eddie Gilbert used to take a bump, Eddie Gilbert would get punched or to sell a punch, he would literally fall back, sort of like jumping in the air and land on the flat of his back so that the entirety of his back would absorb the bump. And as I was watching it, I go, apparently Lex Luger has been watching Eddie Gilbert matches or something, because that's the way he was selling every offensive move that Ricky Steamboat was doing in this match. Now, let's start off at the very beginning of the match. They have an interview in the back with Lex Luger, and it's Gordon Solie standing there with Lex Luger. And I'm much like you. I'm going, oh God, we got to hear Lex fumble over an interview. And yet amazingly, it's a totally competent, solid interview from Lex. I couldn't believe it. And what's great is at the end, Gordon sort of gives that little and goes, arrogance versus prudence. And they just cut away to the ring. They start the entrances to the ring. And Ricky Steamboat, I hated this part of his character where he'd come to the ring with the little Komodo dragon. He's got the Komodo dragon, and the Komodo dragon, folks, is wearing a leather vest. I mean, come on, really. And, of course, there goes Bonnie and little Ricky out to the ring. Hated that part of his character. The family man, that was just a way for fans, like young adult men, to totally hate the guy. That it, you know, here we've got to support this guy who, while he's a world-class wrestler, he's selling the fact that he's a family guy. He loves his wife. He loves his little boy. And that's all great, but that's not what, you know, early 20s guys want to see. Lex comes out. He looks exactly what, at this point in wrestling, you'd want your world champion to look like. He had a great body. He had a great look. His hair was perfect. And what's that Warren Zevon song? Werewolves of London. His hair was perfect. They come out, they got double rings because they're doing, a battle royal that night. I hate when there are double rings because I think it takes away from what happens in the ring. They do a great spot in the beginning of the match where Lex Luger objects to the stipulations of the ring, of the match, and it informs Tommy Young that if Ricky Steamboat doesn't agree to the stipulations as Lex wants them, he's leaving. And the crowd immediately just starts hating Luger. And I thought it was incredibly well done, very effective. The match starts off. I love the start of the match because within the first 30 seconds of the match, there's probably 5 or 6 two counts where Ricky Steamboat's getting Lex Luger down. And Luger's all flustered and stuff like that. They mention that Ricky Steamboat, they talk about his amateur background. I thought it was interesting. They said, oh, he was a Florida champion at 154 pounds, which considering how big Ricky Steamboat is, it's sort of, to me, it was exposing the fact that perhaps he wasn't a natural heavyweight, And then there's a moment in the match when Steamboat is down, Luger goes for cover, and the ref gives him a 1-2, Steamboat kicks out, and Luger gets in Tommy Young's face and says, 1-2-3, I want you to do a quick 1-2-3. And I just about busted out laughing because I'm sitting there going, wow, Lex is so good in this match. I can't believe it. One of the other things I was going to mention, tell me what you think about this, Barry. When Ricky Steamboat came out, okay, he had lost the world title back to Flair probably 6 weeks before this. When he comes to the ring, the way he's introduced by Gary Michael Capetta is the former heavyweight champion, Ricky Steamboat. They don't say the former world's heavyweight champion. And I know this is semantics, and maybe there's somebody out there now, rolling their eyes going, oh, my God, what are you making a big deal out of this for? But I thought that was like, why not say that he's your former world's heavyweight champion? You know what I mean? Am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're 100% right, too. And Gary Capetta is kind of a polarizing individual when it comes to ring announcing. Some people seem to absolutely love him. Others are kind of like, eh, you know, it is what it is. He's a super nice guy. He's extremely extremely savvy on social media, and he's been doing his one-man show all across the country. That being said, yeah, if the guy was your former world's champion, you'd want to put as much importance as possible on this match that's going to be taking place. You'd want to list those credentials. So I'd have to agree with you on that, too. And you brought up the whole Bonnie and Little Ricky, Richie Steamboat, and the Komodo Dragon, just brutal. And it's brutal. It's, you know, Bonnie comes out first, actually carrying Little Ricky with her, and then Ricky comes out right after with the dragon, and it's like, oh, man, brutal. And here you've got Luger, who, you know, conceivably, as the old line goes, every woman in the audience wants to be with him, and every guy wants to actually be him, you know, because he looks like a million bucks. But it's a good match. You know, again, I it's caused me to sit here and go, you know, I was never a Luger fan, and I saw some things from Luger, you know, in those years that I just wasn't a fan of this guy, but he held his own in this match, and obviously working with Steamboat is really, really going to help you.
Yeah, you know, getting back to what I was saying earlier about Lex Luger, Lex Luger was one of the two guys that really exposed the business to me personally, because after seeing so many great years of Florida wrestling in the early to mid 80s, you know, when Dusty was there and Kevin Sullivan, Barry Windham, all the heels that were coming in to work with Barry Windham and Dusty Rhodes, it was such a great time. And then, of course, after Dusty, you know, booked Foot out of town and went up to Crockett, kind of burning the territory down to the ground as he left. That's just my opinion. And they bring in Lex Luger. Barry Windham returns from the WWE. And I was a huge Barry Windham fan. And, you know, because I knew that Barry Windham was a great wrestler. And I saw right away that Lex Luger was a musclehead. He was not a guy. And I would sit there and watch his matches and go, this guy is not that good. And he would do that breathing thing where he would stop and he would huff and puff. And, you know, like he's like on an oxygen tent or something like that. And it would happen not 15, 20 minutes in the match. He was doing that 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes into the match. The other guy was Kendall Windham. And I totally understand why, as a legacy, and he's Barry's brother, but Kendall Windham, he couldn't have weighed more than 175 pounds when he started. And he was a kid that was like in his early 20s, he was already losing his hair. Pushing this guy as your baby face was just a bad idea, because there was nothing about this guy that screamed, you know, heartthrob the way that, you know, Barry, you could sell as this young heartthrob to the girls. Kendall did not strike me as a guy that was going to be a teen heartthrob. And also, because first of all, he was so skinny, and he just at that, you know, he later became, I will say, a competent wrestler. I saw him later when he was doing the, what's the thing in WCW with the Cowboys?
West Texas Rednecks.
The West Texas, yeah. And he worked in All Japan, and he had a good run where he became a real steady hand. But at this point in his career, in like 86, 85-ish, he just wasn't good. And they were pushing him as a main event guy. And I remember I discussed earlier about how I traded tapes with Jeff Steele in Mississippi. Jeff Steele would send me his Mid-South UWF tapes, and I'd send him the Florida stuff. And when he first got his look at Kendall Windham, he goes, yeah, you don't need to send me any more tapes anymore. So, and these two guys, and Lex Luger was the other one that just exposed. I go, Lex Luger is not as good as Barry Windham. And I don't know why they're making Barry Windham have to lose to this guy. And that's part of the whole, you know, growing and understanding the business thing. The one thing about getting back to the Ricky Steamboat match, the one problem I had, obviously politically, Ricky Steamboat was getting ready to leave. His contract was going to be up, I believe, at the end of July or early in August of 1989. The ending, the finish of the match is a DQ. I would have liked to have seen a pinfall, but politically I can understand. It's a very minor annoyance on the match. Other than that, this match is completely a top 100 match of the 80s, as was the night before in Philadelphia, which may have been an even better match. And I'm sure some of the guys that were with me that night, John McAdam, Dave Meltzer, all those guys that went to the Philadelphia show will recall finally that what I think was the greatest night of Lex Luger's career personally.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. And you know, your whole Kendall Windham observation, so I guess we're kind of hijacking this a little bit, but it was definitely spot on. And when I brought it up to somebody who was working in the Florida office, and I brought up Kendall Windham, and it was basically Kendall may have been the greatest guy on the face of the earth. He may have even been a competent wrestler, et cetera. But from a fan's perspective, after seeing Dusty Rhodes for years and guys who were larger than life, all of a sudden you have Kendall Windham. He's a buck 60, buck 65. He's balding, and he wasn't a handsome guy. to put it mildly. And the response to me was, Kendall was a solid worker, and he was a legit tough guy. And my point was, as a fan, none of that was actually translating to what we were actually seeing. So Kendall, though, when you saw him in WCW, and I saw him on a couple of indie shows in between his Florida days and then going to WCW, somewhere in between, he actually became a really good worker. And I even think he was kind of underrated on a lot of different levels. It was a case, I want to say it was the old Eric Watts, where it was a case, a guy who clearly was not ready to be put in the main event position was getting main events in Florida.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, it might be one of those cases. I was listening to the most recent 605 Super podcast, and they were discussing Bruiser Brody and how Bruiser Brody, upon his death, was put on such a pedestal, whether it was by Meltzer, whether it was by other fans, that the person that was talking with Brian, I can't remember his name, is a guy that lives, his name is Alan. He lives in England, I believe. And he said that Brody became overrated by all the publicity surrounding his death. And at some point, that overrated aspect, or what people perceived as Brody being overrated, became so over the top that he almost became underrated. And I wonder whether or not, in retrospect, Kendall was thought of so poorly by the dirt sheets and the Observer and the Torch and all those other things, that at some point when he became a good hand, that he was actually underrated because they were still remembering the Kendall from 5 and 10 years before.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. Yep, you're 100% right.
I like to think so most of the time. Now, our last match that we're going to discuss, we're going back into my top 10. We are going to take a look at a very, very historic match. A match that I'm going to argue may have been, with the exception I was thinking earlier, the exception of Hogan and Andre, may have been the most important match of the decade, strictly from the point of view of what it meant to the territory it happened in, what it meant to the professional wrestling business. And I'm talking Ric Flair versus Kerry Von Erich, Christmas night, 1982 in Dallas, Texas. This was my number 5 match of the decade. Barry, give me some thoughts.
It's such an amazing match, and I want to say that this is about as perfect as you can get, and there's so many factors that go into it. A, the work between Flair and Von Erich, yeah, it's got to be Kerry's best match ever. Flair, obviously, at this stage of his career in 1982, in the early 80s to mid 80s, was just capable of having just tremendous matches. The build-up was really, really strong. There was so much drama throughout this match. And having the two referees, having David Manning and having Michael P.S. Hayes, it really, really made for the match. What I liked, and so you said something probably about 30 minutes ago about Mercer and calling this match and how it's probably the best match. So he really seemed focused. He seemed really into the match, and he's got a lot of great lines. And he's constantly critiquing Michael Hayes as a referee, which I think is hysterical. It's, you know, Hayes is certainly wound up with his intent to referee, and he's saying all these things. But this match, and this is really probably a 4-star match, it's really a backdrop for the heel turn. And you know, the moment that it happens, if you watch those fans, and we talked about these fans just a few minutes ago outside the ring in Mid-South, I don't know, but, you know, if you watch this, when Hayes and Gordy, after the slam and after Hayes has left the ring, when they start to walk back, there's fans going for them. And it's not just male fans, there's female fans that literally look like they're going. And there's this older guy out there wearing a 3-piece suit and a hat. Do you notice this guy?
I did
and
not.
I'm assuming he's some sort of security, but he looks kind of like menacing. Thin, older guy, but just the way he's dressed is really odd. But there are some fans that are up in arms. And this looks like it's one of these situations where it could completely turn into some sort of riot. This is something, if you've never seen it, especially this time of year, it's, you know, we can call this maybe one of the greatest Christmas matches of all time. I think this has to be seen. And the end of the match, you know, when the match is over, and I don't want to give too much away, but when the match is over, though I guess you can spoil after 35 years.
you think?
Right, I guess it's okay at this point. I would say Kevin Von Erich is a little too jumpy in the ring for me. because God knows he's everywhere. And then David Von Erich, such an interesting character to me. David Von Erich gets on the mic, and I don't think he really knew what he wanted to say, and he's kind of kneeling in the ring, and he says, "Hayes and Gordy, now I see what you've given my family for Christmas." And that it just cuts off. Like, I thought there was going to be more to it.
I wonder whether or not, because I believe he does continue to speak, I think it might be something that was edited out by the WWE. Because the version that I saw is a WWE clip. And I have a feeling there might have been some cursing involved. And, of course, God forbid on the homogenized WWE version of the match, you're not going to hear that. Let's just say Jim Duggan and Buzz Sawyer, you're not going to see that on the WWE Network, folks.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what? I'm going to say that you're probably right, because the interview, and it's not even an interview. He says a few words, but it does seem like it just cuts off abruptly. And then he stands up and kind of walks back over to Kerry. And Mercer is selling Kerry having this concussion, you know, that he's not acting right. I think he keeps saying that as well. He's not acting as Kerry always acts. He's got a concussion, but another tremendous match.
Okay, here's where we have a disagreement.
Disagreement alert, disagreement alert.
I don't think this match is a top 10 match. Let me explain. I think this is a top 100 match. I don't think this is the best Flair Kerry match. I think the match we talked about earlier in St. Louis is the best Flair Kerry match I've ever seen. That being said, the spectacle of this match, if you involve the match itself, Hayes's performance as an official, David Manning's performance as an official, Gordy outside, I hate to say this, Bill Mercer selling the angle as the announcer. If you take all that, what it meant to the Dallas territory for the next 2-3 years plus, how much money they made off of Terry Gordy slamming the door on Kerry's head and Michael Hayes turning his back on him. And, you know, I haven't even mentioned Ric Flair's performance, the way that he sold Michael Hayes as, "I don't want this guy being the ref." He's pointing at Terry Gordy when Terry Gordy first is being introduced. "Get the heck out of the ring." Gives him the thumb. "Get out of here, pal." So it's like, he's not embracing Hayes and Gordy as the officials. The spectacle of this angle, this program, and what this match meant to it elevates this match higher. When I put this on the top five, I think I was blinded by how great the angle was by not realizing that the match, while it's very good, is not great. In a lot of ways.
Doesn't that play into it, though? So if yeah, it absolutely has to. There's such an intense drama and such an intense heat. You can almost feel it, I mean, coming through the television set.
Well, let me go back and just go over some notes that I made. First of all, they do pre-match interviews, of course, and Kerry's there. And of course, Kerry's basically monosyllabic. "Oh, yeah, there's a lot of intensity, you know." And they cut away to Bill Mercer. Bill Mercer, for some unknown reason, has the worst choice of style when it comes to facial hair. He has this beard with no mustache, and then he's got this silver thing down his chin so that it's like a multicolored beard. What in God's name they were thinking letting him go on the air with that look, I don't know. Then they cut to an interview with Flair, where Flair's talking about it's not just Kerry, it's the whole family, and Rick's got these beautiful blonde locks with these black eyebrows that have these cuts in them from obviously where he would cut himself, and it's just a horrific look. So then Flair comes out first. That's my first question. Why is the world champion being introduced first? That I always have a problem with. He comes out. He's wearing the red robe. I like the red robe best of all of Flair's robes. The one that I hate the most is the green robe with the sort of yellowish thing, because it looks like when Flair wears that, he looks like a drag queen to me. When he's wearing the red robe and it's got all sort of embroidery, it's just beautiful. He looks like a heel world champion would look coming out to that robe, you know, with that robe. That's a great looking robe. Then Kerry comes out. Kerry's wearing this blue robe. It's almost like a boxing robe. For some reason on the back of the robe, there's a white dove. Just so you're sure of who the baby face in this match was, folks. Let's, you know, Kerry's the dove of peace, I guess. Michael Hayes comes out as the referee. Bill Mercer is telling the story about how Michael won the fan vote over Duke Kiyomoko. who I don't think had wrestled in Dallas for 15 or 20 years, but apparently Duke was so well thought of that he finished second in the voting. And they mentioned that the reason that Kerry was one of the finalists for the referee spot was that Kerry had, or that Michael Hayes had reffed a world title match in Japan, which is just slays me every time I hear that. And then Hayes comes out. He's an official in this important world title match. He's wearing like these faded jeans, no shirt. His hair isn't combed. Apparently, when you're a special referee in Dallas, the stipulation is you never wear your shirt. Because if you recall, we talked about the Killer Khan, Kerry Von Erich match some episodes ago. We were laughing about how Kerry came out not wearing a shirt. Michael Hayes still showing the hairy chest off. Let's see. Mercer mentions that the prior match, which took place in August, that set up the program for the December match. By the way, fans, Kerry did not really lose that match. Kerry is introduced to the fans as the uncrowned world champion. And I'm sitting there thinking, really? I can't imagine Lou Thesz being introduced to the crowd and then the challenger being introduced. Oh, yeah, by the way, this is the uncrowned champ. This guy over here, he's world champion, but he's not really the world champion. And then some of the poetic dissertations that Bill Mercer flows with during this match. It's really funny because there are parts of this match where Bill Mercer is absolute genius in the way that he begins selling the angle. But then during the match itself, he offers up such gems as, this match is flowing like the tides of the ocean. And when he said that, I was like, where the hell did someone write that for him or what? That was just I busted out laughing. Then Flair, I believe, gives Kerry a snapmare, and Bill calls it the flying headmare. He had a way, and like, I think at one spot, he gives him a shot to the chest with a chop or something like that. And Bill, and it's funny because you hear David Manning going, hey, no shots to the throat. And Bill Mercer at the same time is going, he hit him with his knee. And I'm wondering if Bill Mercer is watching the same match that we watch. The angle at the end is so effective. And the way, after dissing him, the way that Bill Mercer begins turning Michael Hayes, as you said, he's getting a little aggressive there. I don't know why he's doing that. And, his foot just brushed the ropes. It wasn't on the ropes. And yeah. Then as Michael begins to turn and he goes, and he kind of, waves off both guys and he's going out. And then Flair knocks Kerry into Hayes, who stumbles into Gordy. And then Gordy slams her. And I don't know whether or not Kerry really got caught with that door or not. You couldn't really see because of the camera angle. But boy, they sold it like Kerry was shot and dead right there in the ring. And Kerry selling like never before as the guy that had the concussion. Well, he was awesome in this one spot of selling a concussed wrestler. And then at the end, like you said, when David and it really cracked me up when Kevin came running down the ring, Hayes and Gordy are in the dressing room and David and Kevin come running down the ring, get in the ring, and Kevin immediately proceeds to rip his shirt off. Yep. I don't know why, because the guys that they would want to fight aren't there anymore, but by God, he wanted the fans to know if things were breaking down, he was going to have that shirt off, by the way. And by the way, let me just show you my shoulders and I've been working on them. And then, David does the, now I see what you got me and my family for Christmas. A perfect angle. I think about the only one during the entire decade that may have been as well done in total was DiBiase and Flair in Mid-South in late 85, just because everyone was so good in their roles for selling this turn and just how despicable Hayes was at the end of the match compared to what he was at the beginning of the match. So well done. But the match itself, I don't think is a top 10 match. It's a top 100 match, not a top 10 match. But again, you should watch this as Barry recommended, and we'll post this on our Facebook page. The spectacle of the angle and everything that was going on is absolute genius. Whether it was Gary Hart, Ken Mantell, the Freebirds, whoever came up with it, just absolute kudos because it was top notch. Barry?
Yeah, definitely. And it almost is, and I mentioned this just a few minutes ago too, it's the match is really a backdrop for the angle. It's a backdrop for the cage door getting slammed on Kerry's head. And it is hard to tell. And there's a spot, the second that Gordy does it, he almost trips over Hayes outside the ring. And it looks like he's doing like a cartwheel almost. So that alone is worth watching this. But there's such an incredible intensity. And I like the fact, too, you know, if you're to find this on YouTube or Google, wherever, you know, we found this, it's a solid 40 to 45 minutes. So between the opening interview, which is a terrible interview, as you mentioned, with Kerry, you know, not the greatest speaker, just not a good interview by any stretch, but this is a great way to spend 40 minutes. And again, if we're talking this time of year, it's Christmas, this show is going to air, you know, this is the last show airing before the holiday. This is the way you want to go into it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Now, folks, it's time to change course here. And the podcast, and as Barry mentioned, our holiday season is approaching us. First of all, on behalf of Barry, I want to wish everyone happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and whatever holiday you might celebrate here at the end of the year. We are going to discuss our top five. Barry, let's try to keep our top five in order this time. What do you say, pal?
Can we do it?
Absolutely.
Are we capable of doing it?
You know, we are highbrow. We are highbrow, yeah. So a highbrow professional podcast like us, we should be able to keep our top five in order. So we're going to do our top five Christmas or holiday movies. Mr. Rose, why don't you give us number five?
So plenty of Christmas presents come with all types of instructions, yet none are as ominous as the following. Never expose to bright light, never add water, and crucially, never feed after midnight. Do you know what movie I'm talking about?
I believe I do. I think you might be talking about Gremlins.
I'm talking about Gremlins. What a great movie, too. And the fact that it's a Christmas movie, and we are discussing our top five Christmas movies, I'm thrilled. I love the movie Gremlins. I love it for several reasons. One is, actually, two of those reasons would be Phoebe and Cates. So I am as big a Phoebe Cates fan as every young heterosexual male that grew up in the 80s probably was. At the same time, this is a really fun movie. It is a little scary. It's a, you know, I saw it, I was 20 years old, and I took my daughter to see this movie a few years back, and I didn't realize the intensity of certain scenes with this movie. But, you know, I love this movie, and there's this great scene where Phoebe Cates, she plays a character, her name is Kate, and she talks about, you know, she's telling this story about why she hates Christmas, and, you know, she talks about the worst thing that ever happened to me was on Christmas. Oh, God, it was so horrible. It was Christmas Eve, and I was 9 years old, and me and Mom were decorating the tree waiting for Dad to come home from work, and a couple of hours went by, and Dad wasn't home. So Mom called the office, no answer. Christmas Day came and went, and still nothing. So the police began a search, and 4 or 5 days went by, and neither one of us could eat or sleep, and everything was falling apart, and it was snowing outside. The house was freezing, so I went to try to light up the fire, and that's when I noticed the smell. The firemen came and broke through the chimney top, and me and Mom were expecting them to pull out a dead cat or a bird, and instead they pulled out my father. He was dressed in a Santa Claus suit. He'd been climbing down the chimney, his arms loaded with presents, and he was going to surprise us. He slipped and broke his neck, and he died instantly. And that's how I found out there was no Santa Claus. Now, really, is there anything better than that if we're talking Christmas movies?
Well,
there's not.
First of all, I think every, as you said, heterosexual man has to have some form of hatred within his heart for Kevin Kline, because Kevin Kline, with his marital vows, scored Phoebe Cates, and so I hate him for that. She's absolutely gorgeous in this movie. She was absolutely gorgeous in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Here's the funny thing, though. As great as Gremlins is, I really enjoyed Gremlins 2 maybe a little bit better. It wasn't the Christmas theme. That's a rare sequel that I think is every bit the equal, if not better. And here's a crazy thing. Hulk Hogan was actually really funny in Gremlins 2. He had this minor part where he played Hulk Hogan, and he was actually really effective and really funny in it. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah, I do. And it's a disagreement alert, disagreement alert.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, I definitely don't think I can agree with you on this. However, there is supposedly going to be a Gremlins 3. And I, as you know, I go to a lot of these, not just wrestling conventions, fan conventions, but I go to the Monster Cons as well. And I was at one this past August. It was either August or March of last year. And Zach Galligan, who was Billy from Gremlins 1 and 2, has announced that there is going to be a Gremlins 3, and he will be in it. So I love the movie, and, you know, I think actually devoting an entire episode to Phoebe Cates should be on our docket for 2018. What do you think?
I think we could do a pretty much an entire episode just on the scene from Fast Times at Ridgemont High when she gets out of the damn pool.
Okay, trivia question. What was the song that was playing as Judge Reinhold is watching her through the bathroom window as she's getting out of the pool?
You really, really disappoint me when you don't think that I don't know the Cars Moving in Stereo, my friend.
Oh, nice, Jeff.
Boom!
Nice.
Thank you.
Boom!
All right, I'm going to go my top five, my number five. Now, here's the thing. Barry just did this whole soliloquy from the movie Gremlins. My top five is a great movie that is definitely not safe for work. It's not safe to have the kids around this movie, and that's Bad Santa. Bad Santa with Billy Bob Thornton is one of the funniest movies you'll ever see, and almost none of it can be repeated on a family podcast because Billy Bob Thornton in this movie plays a department store Santa who basically that's his entire life. He makes his living 1 month out of the year being a department store Santa. He has a young guy named Tony Cox that's his elf. He's a black guy that's a midget. And they travel from state to state. There's a little larceny in their hearts, though. So they always make a point of when they visit the different stores, they leave with a little something they may not have had before to help supplement their income. Besides all that, the character Billy Bob Thornton plays of Willie, he's an alcoholic. He may be doing some drugs, too. And he has a little habit of perhaps doing some things that will get him in trouble these days with the Me Too movement. He likes to basically nail the female employees during store hours and in the store, which comes to the attention of Bernie Mac, who's a security guard, and John Ritter, who's tremendous in this movie as this mild-mannered department store manager. He's really good. Barry, tell me what you remember about Bad Santa.
So I love Bad Santa, too, and I think it would have – you had kind of said to me, hey, I'm going to put Bad Santa on my top five list. Had you not, it probably would have made it up on mine. It's a great movie. I think it's got a little bit of everything. It's wonderful that it's got all the holiday stuff, but it is such a foul movie on so many different levels that you've got to make sure who's in the – you know, I have two kids who are underage, so I have to make sure who's in the room with me when I watch this, but – this also falls into one of those movies that you and I always talk about. If it's on cable and I'm scrolling through channels and I see it, I stop and I watch.
And it is one thing I'll say, it's the darkest, darkest movie you can even imagine. I mean, it's they talk about black comedies. This is jet black humor because and again, I can't even emphasize how foul-mouthed this movie is. There's so many just dirty, over-the-top dirty scenes. And you'll sit there and at one point you'll probably be offended by something, but then at the next point you'll be laughing your ass off because it's a hilarious movie. Okay, Barry, we're keeping track. Barry, you're number four.
We're doing great. You know what? We've gone from five to four. So my number four, exactly. We're capable of doing this. The Nightmare Before Christmas. So Tim Burton's
I saw The Nightmare Before Christmas. I did not see The Nightmare Before Christmas. So is that a different movie?
The Nightmare Before Christmas. We'll have to edit that out, no doubt. But The Nightmare Before Christmas is just one of my favorite movies. And to me, this kind of put Tim Burton on the map when in this style of movie. We had seen, you know, he had done some other stuff, obviously, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which I'm a big fan of, Edward Scissorhands, but when it came to this type of animation, this was kind of a breakthrough. And this is, it's a little dark, or maybe it's a lot of dark, but it's a lot of fun. And I really enjoy it. And I imagine almost everybody has seen it, but if you haven't, it's about Jack Skellington, who is the king of Halloween, and he's taking over Christmas and essentially has decided that he's taking over Christmas. And I love it. It's, you know, it's everything to me about that. It's highly unique. It's an original story, nothing like this before or after. And yeah, I don't know what else to say. It's one of my favorite movies of all time.
I actually have not seen that movie. Now I will have
come
to make
on.
It. I'm serious. You know, I'm Mr. Go-To Movie Guy for all my friends, but that's one I have not managed to see, and I'm going to have to make a point to see it before the holiday. My number four, you know, when Barry and I talk about movies, one guy that we can pretty much always agree on that we always love his movies is Bill Murray. And Bill Murray made a movie called Scrooged in 1988. And again, you know, here I talked about how Bad Santa is a dark film. Scrooge is Bill Murray at his absolute darkest humor, because he plays a television executive who would do anything for ratings, and including putting I think he wanted to staple reindeer antlers onto a squirrel.
That's right.
I recall. Yeah. And there's, but besides the darkness of the comedy in this movie, there's an underlying sweetness to his romance with Karen Allen that's really good. It's basically a Christmas Carol retold with some of Bill Murray's sarcastic humor involved, and it's just an absolute treasure. Barry, you remember that?
Yeah, so it's now one of my favorite Murray movies, and I think part of it is he's so unlikable in this role. And what I like about Murray is the fact, you know, I watched Stripes again with my son the other night, and it's probably the 4,020th time that I've watched Stripes, maybe only in the last year. So he's so likable. He's always sarcastic. That's his meatball style of humor. But in this movie, he's just so unlikable. And for me, I start to watch it, and I'm like going, yeah, you're kind of a dick. You know, but it's still funny, but yeah. And with Groundhog Day, it was almost a similar role, but you could see the transition, and I don't quite see it. That being said, it's still a funny movie, though.
Yeah, he kind of does it's almost as if Groundhog Day, he slowly transitions from a heel into a baby face, if we can use wrestling terms, whereas in Scrooged, it's a real last minute baby face change, because he's heel throughout the movie. I mean, that's a valid point, but it's still a great, funny movie. And there are so many people that just have like walk on scenes. There's a great scene with Mary Lou. What's her name? Mary Lou Renner. What's the gym?
Mary Lou Henner, right?
Yeah. No, not her.
Mary Lou Renner. That's a wrestling name, isn't it?
Exactly. That's the girl I'm thinking about. That was the gymnast. That
right.
she just says it's really funny walking, and I love when people come in you're not expecting to see, and they have hilarious scenes in the movie. And that's another one. Okay, before I sound too idiotic, why don't you tell me your number three Christmas movie?
My number three Christmas movie is what happens when a little 8-year-old boy is left alone in his house as his parents run off to Paris. So for me, it's Home Alone. This movie came out in the early 90s. I remember going to see it. I believe I actually went on Christmas Day. And it's just such a fun movie. You know, this is the kind of movie that I think anybody can watch. And I always relate to my kids, but I remember the first time that I showed them Home Alone, and they just sat there. And when the movie was over, they were walking around and they kept calling each other, "You filthy animal, you filthy animal." They were so enthralled with this movie. And it's just so much fun. I think the direction was great. Macaulay Culkin did a great job for a little kid in the movie. But the real stars of the movie to me are Daniel Stern and Joe Pesci, and they're just great. And somebody put something on Facebook. Do you know where I'm going with this, by the way?
No.
When I say Facebook about a week ago?
Oh, the thing with Macaulay Culkin now?
No, not that. We can talk about that. Macaulay Culkin apparently pulled some wrestling angle at a show out in California the other night. But there was a Facebook meme that was going around, and it said, "Have you seen these two men?"
I saw that.
They're attempting to break into homes, and it's a current picture of Daniel Stern and Joe Pesci. And apparently, people didn't get it, and they were actually contacting the police. Which, yeah, is really funny, but I think this is just a great movie. And I don't know, I was probably in my 20s at this point when this movie came out, my late 20s. But I can imagine if you were a little kid watching this movie, this would be like everything for you. This would be like the dream, to be left home alone and ordering pizza and fighting off the bad guys and doing all that. So I was never a big fan of the sequels. Two was okay, and then I think I pretty much stopped after that. But this first one, I think, is just a classic holiday movie for me.
What's the name of the woman that plays the mother? It's Catherine something, I believe.
Catherine O'Hara.
She is perfect in that role as the mom that realizes what she's done and becomes completely terrified. She's a really, really good character actress. I really like her. I agree. You're spot on about Stern and Pesci. They're the stars of the movie. The guy that is in that does the scene on TV, "You Filthy Animal," he is a character actor that was used.
Yes, he is.
And a lot. Do you know what his name is?
Burt Remsen.
He is used in all kind of 80s cops movie. He was in a movie called Code of Silence. He was in Above the Law. He always plays like the dirty cop. And all
he
those
plays the dirty cop. And what's interesting, it's all movies that are all set in Chicago.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And you know, so Code of Silence, which I love Code of Silence, he played Craigie. And yes. Yeah, remember that? Yeah. He's great.
A director named Andrew Davis, who's the guy that made The Fugitive and made a lot of those movies that were, as you said, based in Chicago. He used like the same troupe of actors that were all Chicago based. Some of them were ex-cops, and he used them in all the different movies. There was a movie with Gene Hackman that came out in the mid 80s called The Package that was set in Chicago. And all those same guys that were in, you know, Code of Silence, Above the Law, The Fugitive, all that group of same Chicago actors were in that movie, The Package, too, which is a great underrated film. That's another topic for another show, though. Now, if you're done, Barry, I'm going to go to my number three. Are we still on number three? Are we keeping track here?
We're number three, and I'm very excited to hear your number three pick.
My number three, I'm glad you're very excited, is a movie that came out in 2003. I am a huge Saturday Night Live fan, and the post Belushi, Chevy Chase, Bill Murray guy that I like best is Will Ferrell. And Will Ferrell made a movie called Elf. And this movie just absolutely slays me because Will Ferrell totally becomes this character of the elf that comes down from the North Pole. His name is Buddy. And he comes down to meet his real father. He's played by James Caan, who lives in New York City. And there are more one-liners in this movie than you can shake the proverbial stick at. When he confronts the department store Santa and says, "You're sitting on a throne of lies." When he says, "Santa, I know him." There's just so many funny scenes in this movie. Barry, are you a fan of this movie?
I'm a huge fan of this movie too. So and again, this will be the 55th reference of my kids during this episode, but I took my, both kids to see Elf on the big screen last Christmas holiday. We have one of these retro theaters where they show, and I took the kids to see Gremlins and the original Jaws and Ghostbusters, but I took them to see Elf, and this is my kids' favorite Christmas movie, Elf, and they just love Buddy, and you're right too when you say there are so many one-liners and there are so many quotes, and Will Ferrell just does this amazing job, you know, in this movie. And, you know, and there's the scene where he's walking in the park and he's with the kid and he's like, "So good news, I saw a dog today." And, you know, and my kids start going, "Good news, I saw a dog today." So I love this movie. This is a movie that I think I can watch in the middle of summer and I'm still going to enjoy it.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I talked about was, you know, Will Ferrell. He has a great, great supporting cast in this. Like I said, James Caan. James Caan's one of those guys that you think, well, you got to kind of disappear off the face of the earth after all those Godfather movies. But James Caan has such an incredible body of work, and he became almost like a character actor as he got older, but he just does such solid work as the sort of grumpy old dad that really doesn't want this kid back in his life. Zooey Deschanel is in it. Bob Newhart is hilarious as the head elf. Ed Asner, great character actor, is in there. Mary Steenburgen has made a career in the last 15 or 20 years of playing moms that are like basically in the, you know, hot older mom category. But a guy that we hadn't mentioned yet that has a tremendous performance in this movie is Peter Dinklage. And Peter Dinklage, I'm sure most people know, is the guy in Game of Thrones. Peter Dinklage plays what Buddy describes as an angry elf, because he asks him if he's an elf. And Peter Dinklage's line when he looks at him is, he says, "Hey, Jackweed, I get more action in a week than you've had in your entire life. I've got houses in L.A., Paris, and Vail, and each one a 70-inch plasma screen. So I suggest you wipe that stupid smile off your face before I come over there and smack it off you. You feeling strong, my friend? Call me Elf one more time." And he's the angry elf, and he's so stinking funny in this role. And if you only think Peter Dinklage is from Game of Thrones, please check this movie out, because it's awesome.
Yeah, and I want to think everybody has seen Elf at this point, too, because it is, I think it's maybe this generation's, like, Christmas holiday classic as well.
You're probably absolutely right. So, okay, you're up to number two?
I'm up to number two, and my God, Jeff, I think a standing ovation for the both of us. We have gone from 5-2 with no errors thus far.
I think our producer's pretty proud of us, my friend.
Yeah, I know my wife is actually proud of me now that I'm making all these improvements. But yeah, so
the
for
whole
me,
counting this thing is working out.
you know what? The fingers are coming in handy, so I'm really happy about that. But so mine is about, it's about a family, and it's a family who is spending some time together. And previously, this family had taken a car trip from the Midwest, and they had gone out west. And the second time they had taken a plane over to Europe. So obviously I'm talking about Christmas Vacation. And Christmas Vacation to me is just such a fun movie. I can watch any of the vacation movies. And I would say the first one is in my top 20 movies of all time. But Christmas Vacation to me is just so much fun. And, I think the standout character, as maybe it was in one and three, because two it wasn't, is Eddie. It's Randy Quaid playing Eddie. He's got all, we just talked about one-liners. This whole movie is basically one-liners. You know, there's a scene in here where the next door neighbor is played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, pre-Seinfeld, and her husband. And the husband is staring at Eddie, Randy Quaid, and he's draining the RV toilet. And Eddie looks over at Todd and he goes, "Merry Christmas, the shitter was full." And I just think it's just so funny. And there's a scene here too, you know, and Clark has this thing that he does in every movie where he has this freak out and gives like this 30-second kind of spiel about, you know, what we're going to do. And he has this freak out where he talks about Christmas and, you know, and everything has possibly gone wrong. So I love it. Christmas Vacation to me, my number two Christmas movie, and could have been number one, except my number one is one of my favorite movies, maybe my top 15 movies of all time. So what did you think of Christmas Vacation?
First of all, we're going to get to your number one in a second, and we'll discuss whether or not that really is a Christmas movie. But
I digress.
No, Christmas Vacation is a great movie. It would probably be in my top 10 Christmas movies of all time. Somebody you forgot to mention that's tremendous in a very minor role is Brian Doyle Murray, who plays Chevy Chase's boss, who screws him on the gift front at Christmas, and is called out by his wife for screwing the employees at Christmas time. Very funny movie, great supporting cast. The family, the turkey that explodes at the dinner table, just a very funny movie.
Yeah, and you're right about that too. And so if I'm correct, and I remember this correctly too, so Chevy Chase was expecting this huge bonus because he was going to put a pool in the back, and he winds up getting the Jelly of the Month Club. So, yeah, so Brian Doyle Murray is another one of these guys. And if we ever do supporting actors or character actors or something like that, I would imagine he's got to be on that list somewhere because his body of work, too. That guy's been in so many movies. We talked about him a few weeks back when we talked about Seinfeld. He was the Bubble Boy's dad. He was the guy who drove for Yoo-Hoo. Just a great actor. But I love Christmas Vacation, and I've actually got it already queued up on my DVR, and I'll be watching it this weekend.
I can tell you also in Groundhog Day, he played the mayor of Punxsutawney.
He absolutely did. He was the mayor with Punxsutawney Phil. That's right.
And I believe that I was trying to think of what the other guy that was a character actor that had a small role in this that I love, and that's I believe his name is William Hickey, that played the guy with the bad rug that came with the grandmother. Yeah, the scene at the dinner table watching the family eat the Christmas dinner is just absolutely a hoot. Okay,
can I hijack for a second? I have a great William Hickey story.
Lay it on me.
So 1986, this is prior to you and I actually becoming the brothers, but I was living in New York City, and I was a Gestapo paparazzi. And essentially that was somebody who had a camera would take photos and then sell them to magazines or newspapers. I didn't have a steady employer. I wasn't commissioned by anybody, but I knew where celebrities were, and that was generally on Broadway. So at the time, William Hickey had a supporting role in a show called Cuba and the Teddy Bear, something similar to that, Cuba and his Teddy Bear, and it starred Robert De Niro, Ralph Macchio, and then in a supporting role, it had William Hickey. So I was there, and I was one night, and it was the middle of summer, which was a time when a lot of celebrities would actually come into town to see these shows. So not only would you take photos of the people starring in the shows, but all the celebrities who were actually buying tickets and going to see it. So I was there one night, and everybody had left. It was 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night, and De Niro had already left, and Ralph Macchio, who really were the big stars, and pretty much anybody, all the autograph seekers, everybody left. So William Hickey came out, and I went over and I said, "Hey, Mr. Hickey," I said, "you know, Full House tonight, some bullshit," and I said, "can I actually get a photo of you?" And he was a guy that I guess had acted for years, but had really just become in the spotlight in the last couple of years prior to that because of Prizzy's Honor, the Jack Nicholson, Angelica Houston movie. So he said, "yeah, kid, you know, no problem." I was a kid at that time. I still had hair. So he said, "kid, no problem." So I took a couple of photos. I still have them to this day. And this is not safe for work, what's going to be coming up. So, you know, spoiler alert. So he looks over to me and he goes, "you see that girl over there?" And I said, "yeah." And he goes, "you know, she's out here every night." And I didn't know what to say to him. And I said, "oh, yeah, she's out here every night." And he goes, "have you ever seen a fucking pair of tits like that before?" Just like that. A guy I had no idea, we had never had a conversation before. I just thought that was the coolest thing ever.
That's funny. Good stuff. So that's also is that our first brush with greatness that we've discussed here on the show, Barry? No, because you had a meeting with Gene Marsh. So I'm going to have to step up my game here on the brush with greatness front. So it's time for my number two Christmas movie of all time. Now, this is one of these movies that pretty much during the Christmas season from here, the day we're recording through the holiday itself, you are going to see this movie on some night, whether it's on Turner Classics, TBS, AMC, whatever. You are going to see Love Actually. Love Actually came out in 2003. Love Actually is one of these movies that's got about 15 pretty big-name movie stars in it everywhere, from Hugh Grant, Liam Neeson, Laura Linney, just a tremendous cast. And it basically involves the lives of about 10 people that live in London who are sort of unknown to you as you begin watching the film. Their lives are all interconnected, whether they're related through marriage or blood, and or they work together. And it's all about these people finding love at Christmas time and finding someone to be with. And surrounding all that, it's a great looking cast, is a great, great movie soundtrack. I actually went out and bought the soundtrack to this movie. I kind of hate to admit it because the songs were so good on it. And it's people that I generally am not a big fan of, but it's just such a great thing. And I'll tell you a real funny story. I just happened to last night be watching Family Guy on TV. And as I said, one of the stars of the movie is Liam Neeson. And Liam Neeson appeared in a cameo on the Family Guy episode I was watching. And there was a great line in the episode where Liam Neeson is getting into a verbal altercation with Peter Griffin. And Peter Griffin goes, "and you know, by the way, your character's performance in Love Actually was the second worst of all the episodes in that movie." And I just busted out laughing because that's such an obscure reference to a movie from 15 years ago that he threw in Liam Neeson's face in the heated of this verbal argument they're having. It just absolutely busted me out laughing. Barry, have you seen this movie?
I have not. So here's a funny thing.
Never?
So about 8 or 9 years ago, when I was still managing restaurants, one of my waitresses was somebody who had actually a great sense of humor and somebody whose judgment I trusted, said, "have you ever seen Love Actually?" And I said, "no, never saw it." And she said, "I am going to bring you the DVD and you can watch it." And I sat down with my wife. I think I made it 15 minutes through the movie. And I said, I can't watch this. I want to say they started singing. Am I correct? That there was, in the first 15 minutes of the movie, I don't remember who it was, but a man and a woman started singing to each other. And I said, "you know what, I can't do this." No, I said, where's the gun chases? Where's all the profanity? I can't watch this. And I shut it off, and I've never. And I went back the next day, and I told her, and she looked at me like I had three eyes. Like, she literally was like, "what do you mean you shut it off?" And I was like, "yeah, you know what? Maybe it was just I wasn't in the mood. I don't know. I've never seen it." However, if this is ranked so high on your list of the number two Christmas movies, the best Christmas movies of all time, I am going to purposely get a copy of it. I'm going to check. I'm going to do a search through my cable system, see if it's on, and I'm going to watch it now.
Well, I'll tell you, I, the scene that you were referring to, I don't recall. There is a at the very beginning of the movie, because you get very distracted at the beginning of the movie because they're basically throwing eight different stories at you at the very beginning, and you have to keep track of it. It's much like the very beginning of Game of Thrones when you had all these different stories intersecting. And what happens is at the end of the movie, you realize how all these people know each other. But at the very beginning of the movie, it's this very strange way to start a Christmas movie. You're actually at someone's funeral. And it's Liam Neeson's wife's character, and Liam Neeson, who is the stepfather of this young boy, is basically arranged a musical tribute to his wife at her funeral. And then, but there's so many different interesting characters that intersect. There's this one couple that's played, the guy's name, it's Martin, I have to think of Martin Freeman, who was in the, not the Lord of the Rings movies, the ones before that, The Hobbit. I'm sorry, I was trying to think of it. He played the Frodo Baggins in the Hobbit movies that came out a few years ago, but he plays a guy who's a stand-in on a porno film, and he meets this girl who's also a stand-in, and he's trying to get to know this girl because he wants to ask her out. But the only time they interact with one another is when they're doing stand-ins. So they're both naked and they're talking to one another while they're naked and trying to get to know one another as they're doing stand-in roles for these porno movies. And it's very funny. But, it also stars Andrew Lincoln and Keira Knightley, and they have a really, really sweet relationship in this movie. I won't spoil it, even though, like I said, the movie's 15 years old. But that's like my favorite part of the movie is as Andrew Lincoln plays this guy who's in love with his best friend's new wife, and the way that he tries to work out, you know, coming to grips with the fact that he's never going to be with this girl who's married to his best friend, I think is really a sweet story and makes for a good Christmas movie. And as I said, if nothing else, the music in the movie is just outstanding. So, okay, we are at number one. It's time to begin our discussion as to whether or not Mr. Rose's number one film is actually a Christmas movie. So I will tell you, I know if you Google whether or not this movie, there's a big discussion that takes place as to whether or not this is a Christmas movie. So I'm not the only person that feels this way. Barry, why don't you take it? Tell us what your number one Christmas movie is.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And I think at this point we probably have given it away because there's so much controversy around it. It's Die Hard. And Die Hard, to me, again, it's in my top 15 movies of all time. I watched it 2 days ago. It plays on cable. It is, at any given moment, it is on one of the channels. And I absolutely fucking love this movie. It stars my favorite New York City cop, John McClane. Richard Dawson, you are my number two favorite New York City cop. Big shout out to Richard Dawson, who I know is a loyal listener of not only our show, but pretty much anything on the Arcadian Vanguard Network.
And he's a former host of Family Feud, too. So, you know.
He was kissing all the ladies at one point. Exactly. Absolutely, Richard Dawson was. So I love the movie. And so the controversy, I'm going to assume, is, and I'm unsure what the controversy is, because John McClane is going to a Christmas party at Nakatomi Plaza with his wife, who he separated from, and the entire movie takes place in Nakatomi Plaza, where during Christmas time, there's many references to Christmas. There is Christmas music throughout the movie. I'm unsure where the controversy exists. And there's a great scene. If you remember Theo, and Theo's a minor character, and Theo is the African-American gentleman who takes over. He's kind of the IT guy. He takes over the control desk, and he's sitting there, and he's going, "All right, listen up, guys. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature were stirring, except the four assholes coming in the rear in standard 2x2 cover formation." So there's so many references to Christmas in this. And quite frankly, if Alan Rickman says this is a Christmas movie, which he did at one point, that's good enough for me. I'm with Alan Rickman on this one.
Alan Rickman, also, by the way, one of the stars of Love Actually. So you got that going for you. My number two choice. So, yeah, Alan Rickman, of course, Hans Gruber, might be one of the all-time great movie villains ever. I will definitely endorse that.
I have an Alan Rickman story. I never actually met him. But my wife and I, when we were dating, which would have been somewhere around 96, 97, used to go to this coffee house in New York City called DTUT, which stood for Downtown Uptown. And it was on it was Upper West Side. And we went in and it was winter, freezing cold. And we sat and we were still kind of courting. I was courting her at that stage. if that's such a term these days. And we were having coffee, and I was still trying to woo her. And in comes in 8 to 10 young college students, and right behind them is Alan Rickman. And I believe he was their drama teacher or was directing them in some sort of play. And they sat in all these couches for the 2 hours that we were there, and they were reading lines to each other. And my wife and I sat there, and we didn't move. We watched it. Alan Rickman was such an incredible actor, and did, you know, his body of work was just unbelievable. But when you just said that maybe one of the great villains of all times, Hans Gruber, you're 100% right. He made Die Hard. Bruce Willis was great. I've never liked Die Hard 2, 3, 4, 5, nowhere near what I liked Die Hard 1, and he was the reason for that.
What does that you say, Mr. Cowboy? Yeah, he was tremendous in that role. So now we're at my number one.
Your number one, and I'll do a drum roll for you. But so, what are your thoughts? Is Die Hard not a Christmas movie?
I would say it's a Christmas movie. It's not what we say a traditional Christmas movie, but of course, I'm saying that, and I picked Bad Santa in my top five, for God's sake, which that's about as far removed from a Christmas. You know, it's funny because I was sitting here thinking, well, before I get my number one pick, of course, I was going to give the ones that just missed the list, like The Shop Around the Corner and Miracle on 33rd Street. And I'm like, Bad Santa beat out those two. What does that say about me? That's a definite defect in my character. By the way, I also want to give you a shout out for saying that you courted your wife and you wooed her. You're definitely doing the family friendly version of breaking kayfabe today, I guess. So
yeah, exactly.
It's time for my number one. Drum roll, please.
Hold on a second.
Boom. Number one. Every single holiday on Christmas Day, I believe it's TBS, runs 24 hours straight of A Christmas Story. And if you somehow have managed to live on a different planet and never seen A Christmas Story, which is about Ralphie, the little kid in small town Indiana in the late 40s, and all he wants for Christmas is a BB gun. If you somehow have managed over the last 35 years to not see this movie, what planet are you living on? Because this to me is the ultimate Christmas movie. I can't believe you didn't have this in your top five, Barry. It's just sacrilegious to me. Ralphie, all he wants is a BB gun. All he wants to do is meet Santa and give Santa the intel, so Santa will bring him that. Santa then, in a crushing move, informs Ralphie that he'll shoot his eye out. And that's a recurring theme. A great movie, the famous leg lamp. And as great as Ralphie is, the key to this movie is Darren McGavin, as his character is called the old man. He's Ralphie's father. And Ralphie and his brother Randy, the mother is played by Melinda Dillon, who's, again, as we spoke, one of those great character actresses that just doesn't get enough love. The bully in the town is Scut Farkas. It's not Scott Farkas. It's Scut, S-C-U-T. The kid with the yellow eyes and the braces on his teeth that was constantly harassing Randy and his little brother. Ralphie and his brother Randy when they would go to school. And, you know, Ralphie and his brother are going to school and they're dressed up in their winter clothes. Randy is dressed so warmly that Ralphie says he looks like a tick. And there's just so many iconic scenes of the kid that sticks his tongue on the lamp pole and it gets stuck and they have to call the ambulance to get his tongue unstuck from the lamp pole. Please tell me you've seen this one, Barry.
Yeah, I've seen it probably 100 times too. So to that end, and everything that you just said, this is probably, if you're looking for a traditional Christmas movie that is going to be fun, it's not boring, and I think everybody can relate to it to some degree, this is probably the movie. So I've seen this 50 times, maybe 100 times. I watch it every year because you're right, TBS or TNT, one of them plays it 24 hours straight, and they plug it heavy, and it's great. It's a lot of fun. It's iconic when you think about the leg with the lampshade, which is a lamp. I was reading something online the other day that somebody just created like a 30-foot leg with a lampshade, and it's somewhere that people can go see it now. So this is such a good movie too. And Darren McGavin was great. He was great really in everything that he did. Melinda Dillon was great. The kid was Peter Billingsley, if I'm correct.
Correct.
And I'm not sure whatever happened to him, but I do know the little brother had an interesting career after his mainstream career kind of just it tanked. So I love this movie, though. You know what?
Well,
there's nothing bad I can say about it.
I will tell you a couple things. First of all, Peter Billingsley had a walk-on, I won't say walk-on role, had a very minor role in the just-discussed movie Elf. He played one of the elves at the beginning of the movie. And he, I believe, has gone on to be a director and working behind the scenes. He's made himself a nice living in Hollywood off, you know, in not being in front of the camera. I want to say this movie was written by a gentleman named Gene Shepherd based on his childhood. It's from his book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. And I actually checked that book out from the library a few years back. And as you leaf through the book, it's basically like a short story mixed in with a bunch of other short stories, very funny stuff. And there are lines of dialogue that you see were put directly into the movie. So, and it's also funny, the movie was directed by Bob Clark, who up until this point was best known for directing Porky's. So from going from Porky's to A Christmas Story is quite the leap there. So, but a tremendous movie. So folks, I really hope that you all out there will take the chance. If you haven't seen one of these, I know that, I've got the Barry's, was it number 3 or 4? Which one was it that I hadn't seen? Which one that you listed hadn't I seen? Nightmare Before Christmas, was it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. Number 4, Nightmare Before Christmas, yep.
I'm going to make a point of seeing that. Barry is going to make a point of seeing my number 2, Love Actually, and give it a chance, even if for no other reason, it's because it's such a great soundtrack. So that's what that's what we're going to do. But for Barry Rose and myself, I will say you've been listening to the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdred and Barry. Woo-hoo! Got the new name, Barry. Aren't we great? So, I will say
jingle
thank you for
bells,
flies.
Jingle bells. It's Christmas exactly. Time, everybody.
Exactly. My book, Breaking Kayfabe, is still available at Crowbar Press with my friend Scott Teal. Thank you, Travis Heckle, for the outstanding artwork, the new logo of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdred and Barry. Also, a shout out to my man, Brian Last, and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Said Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And until next time, we'll see you, folks.